Welcome to the 25th episode of the official Espigan podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
And hello, everybody. It's a three-way today, a three-way between producer and technical staff in Graz, me here in Kerbent, across the border from Graz in Hungary, and Ruth Anna Thomassen, who is a senior dietitian, now working on her PhD in Oslo. Ruth started out with an English degree, She started out with an English degree and then went on to do dietetics and then took jobs at various places in the United Kingdom after taking a second degree there. At the turn of the millennium, she came back to assume a senior position at an Oslo Children's Hospital, and she's been there working with the pediatric GI staff on pediatric GI dietary and nutrition issues ever since. She's going to tell us today about the pros and cons of an approach to diet spelled FODMAP, which I think should be pronounced FODMAP, because, of course, it is a map to what you're going to eat. Ruth, what are those six letters? What do they stand for?
Well, they stand for short-chain carbohydrates in your diet.
Oh, there's no way you're going to get those initials out there. Come on, tell us.
Yeah,
F is for?
F is for fructans. It's called fructans, isn't it? Fructans.
We'll go with that.
Yep. And I have to remember the spelling here. It's fructans, oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and something called polyols, which is really like sugar alcohols.
So FODMAP, or FODMAP, stands for fermentables, oligo, di, and monosaccharides, and polyols, FODMAP. And again, it's a map for what you're putting into your body. As I understand it, the concept of FODMAP is that by withdrawing all these substances and then introducing them slowly, one by one, you can make a difference in how the microbiome and the child's intestine, particularly the large intestine, react with one another and reduce some of the complications, reduce some of the problems of cramping, of difficulty in stooling pattern, and so on and so forth. Have I got that more or less right?
Yes, that's perfect, Alex. I think so.
Well, there we are. And when did this come into clinical use in adults?
Well, it was first introduced by Gibson and Shepherd in 2005 as a sort of theory of how you could reduce pain and complications of IBS in adults. And since that's been, it's been gaining sort of popularity all over the world, I think. So, and as a dietitian, I can remember when once this diet, you know, was sort of described to us, and we suddenly had a way of giving relief to IBS patients, which really felt very good, because it's been a long period of trying and failure for many of these patients. It's been in use for quite a while, you know, almost 20 years now.
But data in kids are not very abundant, are they?
No, unfortunately it's not. And we still don't know whether it's actually a diet that, how effective the diet is in kids. And there's only been a few studies. So, mostly all of them are very different, and they have different ways of testing this out. all from trying out the diet for 48 hours to 60 days. So we don't really know that much about how kids can benefit from the diet.
You sent me two articles, one by Chumpitazi in Elementary and Pharmacological Therapy, and the other by Dogan in Northern Clinics of Istanbul. And both of them took a positive stance toward FoodMap.
Yeah. Yes, they did. Both of these had, I think, a pretty good design. It's across, the first one is a crossover design where both all the patients test both diets, both a diet of low FODMAP and a diet which is higher in FODMAP, and the other one has a randomized controlled trial. So and they all follow up the children afterwards as well to see how they respond later. And in the first one, the Chimpitasi, they also look at the microbiome to see if they can identify who will most likely benefit from this diet. Because there is a big difference between some children don't seem to have any benefit at all, and some seem to absolutely have a benefit from the diet. So
I find interesting, however, that when you, as the lead on an Espigan position paper, which appeared last year, on the use of low FODMAP diet in pediatric gastroenterology, that was pretty much a thumbs down, as in there's no reason to start using this as of now.
Well, yeah, you can read it like that.
And clearly, I read it wrong. So tell me what I should have taken from away.
Well, I think that the problem with this diet is that it may be overused. So it's been tried the article says it's looking at all kind of gastrointestinal complaints in children, because it's also being tried out in children with inflammatory bowel disease, children that have other types of gastro diseases, and we needed to see whether there was any sort of evidence for saying, yeah, this is what you can do. And as a dietitian, I can say that, yeah, some children do benefit. We don't really always know who. And this is, of course, a diet that's quite extensive exclusion diet, although it's supposed not to stay on that exclusion for a long time. It's important not to overuse it either. So I think that what we tried to do was to say we don't have enough evidence to say that it is effective, but we do say that you can try it if you pick out the right children. That's sort of the message that we try to get across.
If you pick out the right children. That's a big little word, that IF.
Yeah, sure.
Two letters, and look at all the difference it makes. So how do you pick out the right children?
Well, I think the important thing is to do a thorough assessment first and to exclude things like celiac disease and inflammatory bowel disease, for example. And also that we have to remember that especially abdominal pain, and it's also a big psychosocial symptom. So remember that, you know, some of these children may not have IBS, so it may be psychosocial and not necessarily something that you should try treating with medication or diet. So that's what I mean with that you need to have a sort of pick out the right children, those that seems to have these problems and not respond to other perhaps easier ways of treating IBS.
Easier ways.
I'm
listening. I just want to pick that apart a little bit, because if you're telling a child, every time she approaches the table, no, you can't have that anymore. That's not an easy way to go, is it?
No, exactly. So that's what I meant, that, you know, putting a child on a restrictive diet is not something you want to do if you don't have to. And if that's why we think that if you have to really thoroughly assess the children and pick out those that can benefit from it, which are especially perhaps those with gas production or abdominal pain and IBS symptoms, or unexplained IBS symptoms that you may relate to the diet. And also that, you know, make sure that the children, before you start this diet, have a healthy, normal, regular diet and not have unhealthy eating habits, because that too could give you these kind of symptoms. So I think that was part of what we wanted to say, is that it's gained very much popularity, this diet, but we have to use it with caution. It's not just something that you should just start on whoever. And in my experience, once we had started with this diet or giving dietary advice on this diet in our hospital, we started to get a lot of referrals that we didn't always think were appropriate, because it seemed like an easy solution perhaps to others, while we were thinking this is quite a restrictive diet that you have to be careful who you sort of refer to it.
So who's the gatekeeper? The dietitian?
Sometimes I think it is. But I think also gastroenterologists, you know, they are pretty good at assessing who could benefit or who cannot.
Well, let's go back now to what stage then in the evaluation of patients with abdominal pain does the dietitian get called in?
Yeah.
At what stage should the dietitian be called in?
Ideally, I think, you know, a child that does have gastrointestinal symptoms that you can't explain by anything else. You've tried, you know, you've done your normal tests, like for celiac disease, or tried constipation advice and that sort of thing. Then the dietitian should perhaps come in and see whether is this a child that has a diet that is not healthy or regular, or and is this perhaps a patient that could benefit from the FODMAP diet. So ideally it should be early, but we are a limited resource in many countries in the world, so I think usually it comes pretty late, because it's just saving the resources a bit.
You've asked the question in the guidelines that you sent me of how and who should educate the families and children on the diet.
Exactly.
And, you know, when a question like that posed by a dietitian, the only thing you can say is, of course it should be the dietitian.
Yes,
so we'll just,
I know.
But it should be the dietitian. In the best of all possible worlds, it would be the dietitian. And we're not quite there yet, are we?
No, we're not.
Okay.
And that's why we have to be careful also, because there's a lot of information out on the internet, and not all of that is good information. Ideally, you should have a dietitian to refer to, so that the child and the family can get guidance of how to both exclude and reintroduce, because what we're worried about is actually, you know, just maintaining the exclusion unnecessarily for a very long period, or perhaps excluding things that the child doesn't really need to exclude.
There we come down to a question that I wanted to ask you, and that is, does the impetus toward low FODMAP diet come principally from dietitians, physicians, or families? My thought is that there are a number of food faddist approaches to various perceived problems with health, in which the parents are the ones who are saying, I read about this and we have to try it, or it could be, as I got a hint of, the I can't do anything with this child or with this family. They sit in my waiting room all day long and make my life a misery. Here, would you please take them along and do FODMAP on them?
Well, I certainly recognize both of those. I think in the start it was the dietitians advocating this diet quite a lot because we were sort of finally getting, you know, something that we thought, you know, we can use it. And then after having some more experience with it, have seen that, you know, maybe too many people are being or too many children are being referred for the diet. And I think now more and more families are asking for it. But I do certainly sometimes feel that we get these children that, you know, there's nothing left to do. Let's try the diet. And and then once we've perhaps spoken to the family, realize that this is not a family that it's not suitable for the family. So, it's grasping for a straw sometimes, I think. But having said that, there are, of course, some children that has absolutely benefited from going on the diet. So we don't have all the answers yet. So I think, you know, it's just, I think the diet is described a lot on the internet, and therefore if the family wants to follow it, we will have to take them seriously so that the child doesn't get unnecessary restrictions in their diet.
Take the family on board and say, let's just make sure that this works for your baby, works for your kid, right? Don't exclude them. Draw a circle that takes them in.
Exactly.
Okay.
Very good.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak with a Norwegian, especially because I think of you as really being a quarter Swedish myself. I think of you as Swedes who sort of lost the plot. back in 1905, if I remember right, you folks just got some kind of wild hair and said, "We can't stick it around here anymore. We don't want to be Swedish." All right, fine. You don't want to be Swedish, but you started out at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. You were still part of Denmark, and then in the Treaty of Kiel, right? In the Treaty of Kiel, then the Danes said, "We don't want them," and the Swedes said, "Do we have to take them?" And it was all very complex. Yeah. But now, of course, we have four Scandinavian nations, and leaving the Finns aside as totally impossible, from the standpoint of a Norwegian, the question which all our listeners want to know an answer to is, which are worse, Swedes or Danes, and why?
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to be lured into that trap. But
I did
having
try.
Said that, we are of course, different nations, they're like our siblings. I mean, we bicker and we fight, or, you know, but we also have very much love for each other. And it's always a pleasure to be a Norwegian in Sweden and in Denmark. And I think that's the same for the Swedes and the Danes when they come to Norway. Because the Swedes we actually regard as our big brother. He's the big brother who sort of leads on the trends and everything, you know. And the little brother Norway was always in the past sort of lagging a bit in the back, but that's not really true anymore. But we still sort of call them dear brother, or söta bror, as it's said, söta bror, which means dear brother. And the Danes, of course, they're quite different from the Norwegian and the Swedes, with more an Italian way of being, more, you know, outwardy, and they'll speak out and everything, but, you know, very lovable still. So, yeah.
Well, that's the kind of bridge building from nation to nation that Espigan is all about.
And, exactly.
But Espigan, of course, retains among its members, among its countries, individuality. And at this point in the podcast interview, we generally ask for a little demonstration of that individuality, a song that tells us a bit about Norway and about your attachment, an understanding of what it is to be Norwegian in Europe and in Espigan.
Yeah.
What are you going to give us?
Well, my song is Har du fyr, which means Do You Have Light? It's a song that is written by a Norwegian living very far north. So it describes quite a lot of the harsh nature in the north of, you know, being fishermen and sailing out and having a light that guides you. But I also think that that's sort of what we need always. We need guiding people, and we are perhaps as health professional also guiding people. So this is a song sort of that I think comprises all of that. And if you have a sick child, you need some guidance and you need a light, something that, you know, says it's going to be fine.
Somebody who takes an interest, somebody who stands beside you.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
And I thank you so much for coming to be interviewed today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.